I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Comparing the unique shops and restaurants of cities is one of the pleasures of traveling. Kay Wellman has made it her business to find them, photograph them, and present them to readers in her series of Eat Shop Guides. We'll talk to Kay about the spirit of independence and how it makes cities memorable today on Smart City. Also with us is Michael Sylvester, who has a different story about independence. He's publisher of Fab Prefab, a web resource dedicated to tracking developments in the market for modernist prefab dwellings. If you think prefab is about dreary trailers and look-alike tract housing, then think again, because prefab homes are among the most exciting being built today. That's all today on Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Kay Wellman is the creator and publisher of the Eat Shop Guides. She's a native Oregonian who attended Parsons in New York, then traveled the world doing a stint as art director for Motown Records before landing back in Portland. Your Eat Shop Chicago edition was given to me as a gift, and it's the first book I can remember picking up, opening it, and thinking, this book smells good. Is that by design?
Nobody's ever said that before, Carol. That's a new one. But was it designed that way? I have to say that not intentionally, but I've had people say to me before that sometimes when they see the photographs, that they really have that sense of, number one, immediately wanting to eat. And it's usually the eating before the shopping. The shopping looks good, but something about that food makes, you know, people want to immediately consume edible items.
Describe these guides.
Well, the guides are, they're square, which is a little unusual. They're a 6x6 square guide, and they are easily identifiable because, number one, of their size, but they also have a very kind of clean, modern design, and they are also very identifiable by the fact that we only feature 90 businesses. It doesn't matter if a city is huge like Chicago or smaller like Austin or Portland. We take 90 businesses, or we find 90 businesses that fit into our criteria. And the main criteria is that we're looking for, number one, local businesses, ones that are within the urban core, and ones that are really inspired. We want to be able to walk into a business and usually there's a moan, you know, that comes out, you know, or that sense, you know, of that somebody is behind it that really has a passionate take on what they're doing. And that's what makes these guides really, really different from some of the things that are out there.
Can you tell me what instantly conveys that behind this individual shop or restaurant someone is inspired?
Well, I say that now that I've gotten almost this second sense about me, that I can tell when a business is a marketing concept, you know, or if it's a business plan, or if it came from somebody, you know, who dreamt about having that business since they were, you know, 15 years old. The way that I can usually tell is that sense of a person that when you walk in. Not so much maybe a sense of a, you know, an interior designer, you know, or somebody that designed it or conceived it. So there's a very personal take, you know, on that business, whether it be on the eating side or on the shopping side. And it really, the best way I can say is that it hits you smack in the face the moment that you walk in. And usually you don't have to walk much further than about two steps, you know, to even get more clues, you know, towards that, whether or not it be just from the personal take on it, that you know, more intimate personal feeling, other than the, you know, kind of, you know, more big and kind of glossed over feeling.
Where did the concept for the books come from?
out of me being a really pissed off graphic designer, pretty much. It's a combination of that and also having, you know, my husband owns a small business here in Portland with his family called Pasta Works, which has appeared in the Portland books. And It's been around for 20 years now, and it's the ultimate, you know, small local business. They do handcrafted pastas. They do Italian wines and cheeses, and it's a really magical store. And they were having kind of a rough time because all around them there were some of the bigger national chains that were coming in, and you know, these chains like Whole Foods, they were great, you know, but it was so hard for them to be able to compete against the chains, you know, just big buying power. I mean, they could buy lots of advertising. They could, you know, they could buy, you know, ads on buses and stuff. So, you know, here's this little local business trying to compete. And so, you know, every night I would hear from my husband, it's not been a great week, you know, or, you know, we're having to, you know, to constantly say to people, yes, our cheese is, you know, 2 cents more than Whole Foods, you know, because we don't have 122 stores around the country. And then a lot of my friends also around the country that owned small businesses, both on the eating and the shopping side, their stories were all the same. I just kept on hearing that story over and over again. So I decided to take a road trip. And I told my husband and my then 3-year-old daughter, I needed to kind of figure out what I wanted to do other than being a pissed off graphic designer. And I took all of this information along with kind of my husband's gripes, and I went down to San Francisco, and I went to go to the San Francisco gift show with the intention to go and maybe do some product design and see if my product design would work at a gift show. And I got in the gift show, and I walked around, and I was like, oh, okay, God, no, I can't do this either. There's too much crap in here. I can't do this. So my response was then just to go and walk around the streets of San Francisco, and in the course of that, you know, going into kind of some of the smaller neighborhoods off the beaten path, I started getting in conversations with some of the business owners, and again, I started hearing the same stories that were my husband's stories. And these places were, you know, they were just magical. They were really, really just rich environments, and they all had the same story that they were struggling, you know, to be able to get people to come into their businesses. You know, I think after I heard the last story and I got into my car to drive back to Portland, and it's an 8-hour road trip, you know, I conceived of the idea of these books, and it was able to put together my graphic design background and all of that knowledge that I had, you know, along with, you know, years of going around the world, you know, and basically eating and shopping and exploring and doing that. And 8 hours later, I got home and went to my studio and took an hour and designed the basic concept of the book and came out and showed it to my husband, and his response was, you know, you finally actually come up with an idea that might work. And it did.
I understand that bookstores were not interested at first in carrying the guides. Why?
Well, there's a great story that, you know, after I'd printed the first 10,000 and I didn't have, it hadn't occurred to me, you know, to get a distributor, and certainly, you know, oh God, a distributor. What was I thinking? And in fact, people always ask me now, why don't you have a publisher? Why did you self-publish? I'm like, didn't occur to me. You know, I thought, hey, I know how to, I know how to do the design. I know how to do the production of these. And why don't I just print 10,000, you know, and see what happens? And so it was that kind of cavalier attitude that, you know, had 10,000 of these books descend on me in Portland on, you know, about the second week of December of 2003. And I had a contact down here at Powell's, of course, in Portland, which everybody across the U.S., I think, knows about Powell's. And the front list buyer there, I had a meeting with him, and he looked at the book, and he said, this is great. So this is really great. We like this book a lot, and we're going to order 5. I think for the book business, I mean, there's that sense always of you know, you put in small orders, and you know, then you see if something really works.
So, how did you get the other 9,995 sold?
Well, my mother was really helpful. One of the parts of my business that's been very interesting is that the businesses in the book, a lot of the businesses said, "Well, can we sell the books?" And I said, "Absolutely," because one of the reasons I wanted to begin it, you know, was from this idea of what can I do to help small businesses. I would sell the books into those businesses for a pretty greatly discounted wholesale, so then they could sell them and make a big margin on them. And that was great. That was nice to hear back from the businesses. Like, okay, not only are you helping us because we're in the book, and you're bringing people in, but also, you know, we're selling this and able to put a little bit more cash in our pockets to help us. And so, you know, after that first complete moment of terror, there was an article written about the books here in Portland, and then kind of all hell broke loose. Then I had every bookstore in town calling and asking for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of copies. And so the 10,000 ended up getting sold through relatively quickly. And by January of 2004, I had gotten a wholesaler, and by I think February, I had a distributor, a national distributor. So thank goodness, because that would have been a lot of books in my garage.
How do you decide, Kay, what to include in the guides and what not to include? You said you only include mm-hmm. 90 businesses locally owned within the urban core, run by inspired people. What becomes your tiebreaker?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of times I'll have businesses say, well, you know, are we going to be considered for this? And so, the criteria goes, you know, far beyond that. You know, I guess it falls underneath the umbrella, you know, of my own, you know, personal kind of aesthetic, which is, I think, partially it comes from my design background. And so I'm drawn into places, you know, that have a very strong, you know, sense of design. They have a very strong sense of kind of place. And so, you know, often I've had people come back to me and say, well, your books are about the hip places. And, you know, I'm not sure I completely agree with that. I think that there are places that are in the books, you know, that could be considered hip or cool, but there's also places that are in the books that, I mean, I don't think that hot diggities in Chicago would necessarily be called cool by anybody. And, you know, so I'm looking, you know, I'm just always looking for something that it seems to kind of transcend. It seems it's special. I mean, yes, I love modern, you know, yes, I love great design. I love places, especially in the shop side, where you see an incredible sense of merchandising, an incredible sense of telling a story. I mean, I think that is also a big part of it. There's a lot of businesses that are out there that maybe they have one part of the picture, you know, but then they don't have the other parts of the picture. And, you know, and that's kind of a hard one to describe and sometimes even to say back to the businesses, like, You might be carrying some really interesting lines, you know, but, you know, you unfortunately you just can't hang a, you know, a hanger up on a rack, you know, in the store, you know, and then expect it to be kind of compelling. So I'm that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for, I guess, what is compelling.
You've produced guides now for how many cities?
Well, I was thinking about that in the car on the way here, and as of last fall, it was 13 cities. Today, it was going to be 20 cities by the end of this year, and it's actually gone down to 19 because this morning I've got authors right now that are kind of on the road, and I've got authors in both Nashville, North Carolina, so on and so forth. And unfortunately, we kind of learned today that both those markets we thought weren't quite right yet, you know, for doing the books, and so we're rolling things around and sending somebody up next week to Montreal. And I think we're excited about Montreal. That will be only our second Canadian city.
What makes one city's places to shop and eat different from another?
Well, it's interesting because I think that I've talked about this a little bit in the past, where one of the criteria also for being in the book is that you have to be in the urban core. I mean, I have people in businesses all the time say, well, you know, we're out in the suburbs and we think we'd fit in, but, you know, it doesn't look like you do the suburbs. Why not? And you know, I have this concern about the cities across the United States losing, you know, the vibrancy within their urban core. And one of the things that I say, you know, is that I think it's the small local businesses, you know, that really define, you know, the spirit and the nature, you know, of the city. And they really give it its soul, and they also are part of what gives, you know, a picture to the city, you know, and a vision. And so I can gauge, you know, I can describe to you, you know, what the difference is in between Portland and, let's say, you know, Austin and Chicago. I mean, the small businesses in Austin, you know, they have a they have this kind of just slightly funkier, you know, maybe, you know, a little, it's like they bring in a little bit of Texas, you know, that they combine then with kind of an urban feeling. And it's the same way with Portland, where what you have is that, I mean, Portland to me is It's either the smallest urban city in America or it's the largest town. I mean, I can't figure out what it is, but it's Portland has a very almost kind of, you know, European feeling, Copenhagen, Amsterdam feeling, and yet it's a very, you know, it's a small American city. So you really get that sense through the small businesses and through the owners, you know, and what their connection is to the town. So I feel like you can look at each of the different books and after you go through the book, you can get a sense, you know, of what that town, at least on the eating and shopping side of things, you know, is about.
Has there been a city that surprised you in terms of its character as expressed through its shops and restaurants?
One that surprised me. I guess I was a little bit surprised by San Francisco when I did the San Francisco book. I'd been in San Francisco a lot, especially in the late 80s, early 90s. But when I did the book, you know, San Francisco is so well known for its incredible eating. I mean, it's probably, you know, the biggest foodie town in the United States, I have no doubt. And hordes of people come there to shop and such. And I think I ended up being surprised because there were lots of great places to eat and to shop. But sometimes I felt that, you know, when it came to the more, you know, what I was looking for, the more intimate, you know, local places, you know, that there wasn't as much as I thought. And I was surprised by that. I mean, that was a little bit shocking to me. And I thought San Francisco, you know, would be really the you know, just be bursting at the seams of places like that. And I think that there'd be people out there that would argue with me. But I was surprised by it. And so, in fact, this time I'm about to do a second edition, and it's going to be the San Francisco Bay Area. And I'm going to include the entire East Bay because I think it's what's going on over in Oakland and Berkeley is really interesting. And so I think it's kind of a disservice to do, you know, the Bay Area without doing the East Bay.
Do you find people using your guides as actual travel books?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I see them being used kind of 50-50. I mean, quite often I'll be sitting here in a restaurant in Portland and somebody will sit down next to me and they'll pull the book out of their bag and they'll have, you know, maybe a dog-tailed page, and I'm always amazed by that when somebody does that. And sometimes I'll begin a conversation with them, and they'll say that they live here in town, and they just use it because it's the easiest way. They want to go through and try all the different places, and they're amazed that they didn't really know about all those places. I think that, you know, for an actual travel guide, if you're using it to go someplace else, it's a great guide, you know, to use along with, you know, if you need to know kind of, you know, the monuments, if you need to go to, if you want to do the sightseeing, you might want to use it along with something else, because really all we're talking about is the eating and shopping. I did decide at a certain point to add 4 or 5 hotels in because I figured you've got to do some sleeping in between all that, the rest of that. So I added that in. But, you know, we just did our first European guide for Paris, and that's doing great. And it made me a little bit nervous at first because I thought, you know, wow. I mean, there's no other information in here at all. But then again, you know, if somebody goes to Paris, they and especially for the first time, they might have a bit of an agenda, you know, on the sightseeing, and they might already know that agenda, you know, i.e. Eiffel Tower, Louvre. So I'm not sure I need to, you know, tell them that. And it's pretty easily accessible off the web. So,
it does seem like people are making shopping more a focus of their travel today.
Yeah, do you think so? I mean, I think it's. I mean, sometimes I don't know if it's I worry so much, but you know, I'm always saying to people, you know, especially the name of the guides, you know, eat, shop, like, you know, fun. We're going eating. We're going shopping. You know, we're very materialistic, and yet I always feel that there's the understory to all of it. You know, which is that. You know, you're getting to experience, you know, kind of walking the streets of the city, you know, via this guide, and hopefully it's just a little bit deeper than, you know, the full blown consumption. But yeah, I mean, I guess people do go directly to places, you know, to do just that. I guess I do. I have to accept that.
Which is your favorite guide and why?
Oh, my favorite guide. Well, I will admit my new favorite guide right now is the Paris guide. The John Hart, the author, I think. Really hit the nail on the head, and in fact, I'm heading to Paris in about 3 weeks to, you know, to go in and check it out myself and make sure it works well. But I sure love that guide. I think his writing is really fresh and engaging, and his choices are exciting. And, you know, I had the same reaction that other people have when they see that book. I mean, as I was putting the book together, you know, I mean, I kept on saying to my husband, it's like, I've got to go to this place. Okay, no way. I've got to go check out this place. Oh, my God, that, you know, that crepe place looks amazing. I'm going to go check that out. So that's probably my new, you know, that's my favorite book, I think, by somebody, by another author within my little tribe. But I think the favorite book that I've ever done myself, I mean, it's probably a tie in between Austin. I mean, just I love Austin and really enjoyed doing that book. And I, you know, I always love doing the Portland books. I mean, Portland, I'm biased. It's a special place. So I always have a great time doing it, doing the book here.
Which cities are in the works?
So we have three new books coming out that'll be out in May. It'll be a new edition of Los Angeles, a new edition of Seattle, and then the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And then for this fall, we have a new San Francisco book, the San Francisco East Bay book, and we're going to do a New York City book, which I think is going to be a great book, fantastic book.
Kay Wellman is the creator and publisher of the Eat Shop Guides. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetizen assistant editor Nate Berg.
Right now, it is the place for redevelopment in cities across the U.S. But is the old song right? Will things really be great when you're downtown? Not if the downtown you're in is in Las Vegas or in San Jose, California. A recent article in The Economist outlined attempts by the two cities to revive their city centers and the disappointing failures that followed. In San Jose, the burst of the dot-com bubble brought downtown office vacancies to record highs that have continued to climb ever since. The city has tried to lure developers with tax incentives and even free land, but the area continues to struggle. Meanwhile, downtown Las Vegas is experiencing a similar fate, suffering while the main Las Vegas Strip enjoys exponentially greater occupancy rates and economic activity. But downtown Vegas is fighting back, forcing people to come to the city center by relocating county, state, and federal courts to the historic downtown. But even with a boom of lawyers occupying downtown buildings, the area still lacks the permanent residents it has sought for years. Another problem facing urban areas is the lack of affordable housing. This issue is not just affecting lower income brackets, but also the middle class. According to an article in Apartment Finance Today magazine, more and more middle-class residents in urban areas can hardly afford to rent homes, let alone buy them. A Harvard University study reports that in 2004, more than 15.8 million people were paying more than half of their income to rent housing, the equivalent of about 44% of the nation's 36.2 million renter households. Housing experts are projecting an increasing nationwide trend in renting households due to higher housing prices. And in other nationwide statistics, USA Today recently reported that ridership on U.S. public transit systems has seen a big increase, rising to its highest level since 1957. More than 10 billion bus and rail trips were taken in 2006, a 2.9% increase from 2005. This according to the American Public Transportation Association, a nonprofit transit advocacy group. However, critics of public transit subsidies argue that the Transportation Association's statistics overlook the fact that the percentage of total passenger travel that utilized transit was actually lower in 2006 than it was in 2005. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Michael Sylvester about the modernist prefab movement and the gorgeous buildings it's producing. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Michael Sylvester is the man behind Fab Prefab, an online resource promoting the modernist prefab movement. He's also content strategist for Dwell Magazine. Michael works as a business consultant and holds an architectural science degree from the University of Sydney in Australia and an MBA from the University of Chicago. When most Americans hear the words prefab housing, they probably think of trailer parks. You're trying to replace that image with something much more chic. Describe the best of prefab today.
Well, the best of prefab today is very different to the trailer parks most people imagine. The best prefab today is designed by architects who are very innovative, have progressive design ideas, and are using a palette of materials that's a lot more robust and better performing and built to a higher quality than what most of us know prefab to be traditionally. So it's completely different to what most people imagine.
Dwell Magazine, a terrific magazine, seems to have made the promotion of prefab its very own cause. Why?
Well, I think it's got to do with helping to change the quality of our built environment. Dwell's always been about providing modernism for everyone, good design ideas available to everyone. And prefab is a way of making good design accessible. It's a way of getting architects' ideas into more people's lives. And so it's a means to an end.
You say getting architects' ideas into more people's lives. Tell me how prefab does that.
Well, I like to joke that architects are like poets and philosophers in that we all know what they do, but when was the last time you hired one? The challenge is that architecture is a service-based business that is complex and somewhat mysterious to most people. So even people who are seeking progressive design solutions, people who are looking for innovative ways of living, trying to redefine what home means to them, access to an architect is something that is a challenge because really you're putting your hands, your design ideas into the hands of an architect. You're saying, let's head off on a sort of journey of discovery together and see what the outcome will be. And you don't know till you've finished, really, how long the project took or what it cost or what the outcome was. What prefab does is prefab allows architects to, in essence, convert a service-based business into a product-based business. It enables the architect to say, I'm going to envisage some different designs for homes, and I'm going to market them as product to people and say, here's a house, and here's what it costs, and this is what you get. So it introduces a degree of predictability over the whole process and the outcome that is appealing to people in a way that traditional architecture isn't, and that unlocks a much greater market share than traditional architecture does. So prefab enables architects to get to a larger market share.
Does the pipeline exist today for architects who want to design prefab work? They don't want to put it into production themselves. They didn't go to school for that. They want someone else to handle the manufacturing and the setup and the installation, etc. But they just want to design. Is that pipeline today available to them to make that happen?
It is, but not in an efficient manner. This is one of the challenges that architects face who are doing prefab. Because architects traditionally design objects. They design dwellings, and they don't design the process that delivers the dwellings. That is usually evolved in a partnership with contractors, and it's somewhat an ad hoc process traditionally, where a group of different construction people will assemble as a team for the life of a project just to get it done, and then they disperse. Whereas what you're talking about is architects tapping some form of production system that's predictable and that architects can design for, and someone else will manufacture on their behalf. And this is something that is not available as an open marketplace, so architects cannot phone around different factories and say, how much will you charge to build my prefab I've designed? And architects wish that was the case, but it's not. So the architects that are making the greatest inroads in prefab right now, selling the most homes and making the most noise, are evolving those relationships and those systems themselves. So some of them are buying and building their own factories, and others are visiting existing home building factories and asking them how they can work together, which is a challenge. Because there are and have been for decades factories that build prefab homes. whether they're what we would colloquially know as a trailer home or other modes of modular home. But they tend not to have the design values and the materials that architects are seeking. They're very much production-driven entities that produce similar-looking homes all day, and there's a great business in that. So architects have to go to factories like those and try and find a way to work together with different materials and different processes, and it's a challenge for the architects, it really is.
How big is this market today? What percentage of residential construction or production would this represent?
This kind of architect design prefab, which is really what we're talking about, it's not prefab in general, but architect designed prefab, is absolutely minuscule. I wouldn't even be able to put a percentage number on it. It's a thousandth of a percent or something. It's very small. But it's gathers a lot of media attention because the designs are very evocative and promising, and it represents a new way, new access to new ideas for people that are fed up with the status quo, people who want alternative choice in housing. So the numbers are very small, but the potential is very large.
When you think about the benefits of prefab to the home buyer, besides the ability to get an architect-designed home, which is significant, what other benefits might there be?
Well, there are a few benefits. The first is you can generally expect it to cost less than custom architecture provided by an architect. These homes are not less expensive than what we might call cookie-cutter production homes from tract home builders that mass-produce housing. But if you were to visit an architect and commission custom architecture, that's going to be more expensive than buying a prefab home that has been designed by an architect and has similar design values and built out of similar materials. So there's some money saving. The second is, generally you have compressed project timelines, and time is money. So, for example, with prefab, while a site is being prepared, while the foundations are being laid, elements of the dwelling are being built in a factory. And that means that you're getting two things done at the same time. And when the dwelling gets delivered to the site and assembled, the project ends up being completed much faster than if you're using traditional on-site construction techniques. The other benefit, I think, to the home buyer is generally these prefab homes are built to a very high production quality. Most of these homes, the prefab homes that are built in factories that are good quality, are built on flat benches under good lighting. They're built, they have quality control following them all the way through. This is very different to going out on a construction site where you see contractors that are trying to get the job done as quickly as possible, and you know, the quality control is not always there. The other point is that a lot of these dwellings that are prefab need to be, especially the modular ones, need to be trucked down the freeway on a big truck or down the road. Now, the kinds of forces on those modules while in transportation are often greater than the forces placed on the home once it's in use. In other words, these homes are designed to be very strong in order to withstand transportation, and that makes them more than strong enough and durable enough as homes. So they're stronger and more durable and going to stand up well to a storm compared to some other homes.
Mm-hmm. Is this a market, Michael, that necessarily gets opened up city by city? Because I know on the receiving end, once the home is constructed in the factory, once it is it travels to the location, then it also has to be in effect installed. Is the installation something that requires specialized skills, so that if you don't have those specialized skills in the market you live in, then it would be hard to actually get the home installed?
It depends on the mode of prefab. Some prefab homes are really kits. In other words, the pieces of house arrive as a flat pack kit and are assembled on site. And those kind of projects require not specialized skills necessarily, but construction labor to assemble. Whereas some other modes of prefab that we generally call modular homes, these are the ones that are built in the factory to a much higher degree of completion. They arrive as big boxes that they then get craned into position. And so they need less on-site labor to install them, but you do need access for a crane and so some sites make that unusable. The modules that are built to a higher degree of completion actually allow for projects to be built in areas where there are very few skilled trades available. So one trend we've observed is that you have clients who buy sites that are in remote locations, that are in very scenic or iconic rural areas, and they truck these modules out and place them. And there are no building trades available anywhere near the site that could have built a site-built house, let alone anything else. So some modes of prefab actually unlock the ability to build beautiful architect-designed homes in areas where there are no local or few local building trades at all.
You mentioned the rural sylvan sites. One of the things I notice in Dwell when a prefab home is featured, it seems like they're always out in the woods and they're in some pristine setting with a great view. Does prefab not work in city settings?
It's not that prefab doesn't work. There's a couple issues. It certainly, you could argue, works easier in rural settings because it enables you to put a dwelling in an area where no trades are otherwise available. So in some sense, there has been pent-up demand to put vacation homes in beautiful areas, but there's been a lack of trades to help build them. So if the homes are not prefab, they still can't be built. One of the challenges of building in more built-up or dense urban areas is the economics of construction are different, and generally designs need to optimize the value of the site. So you need a higher degree of site specificity in the design in order to leverage the higher cost of the land in more dense urban areas. And so no architect is seeking homogeneity in design, but to the extent that some architects have pre-configured home solutions that might assume views and a certain footprint, they tend to work better in more remote locations where those views are available and there's not a need to maximize the use of every square foot of the land. Whereas some of the urban plots that we see, the owner, whether it's a developer or individual, has generally paid more for that land because of its location, and they need a design that's very site-specific. And that calls for more design services. And that kind of project suits pre-configured prefab less than site-configured prefab.
Michael, is there a challenge to prefab with city codes?
Generally, no. There's great misunderstanding because when people use the expression prefab, even people in city building departments think you're talking about what we know as trailer homes. Whereas the bulk of the prefab that we're talking about, that we're looking at, is built to exactly the same building codes as a site-built home. They just happen to have built the house in a factory and not on site. So we're not talking about delivering a completely different type of animal. We're just talking about a difference in the process by which it was created and delivered. So some cities, some of the residents, are hesitant or resistant to prefab coming to town because they think this is an invasion of mobile or trailer homes, or any house that gets delivered by a crane, you know, something's different or odd about it. It makes them feel uncomfortable. But strictly speaking, in terms of code, the bulk of the prefabs we're looking at are built to exactly the same code as any of the neighboring homes. And in fact, paradoxically, they're built to a much higher quality and we think will assess for higher value in the long run.
Is a prefab home necessarily greener than a home of traditional construction?
It is in one sense, in that prefab homes in their construction process are much less wasteful. So even if the architect does not build in any green features of the home, which I'll talk about in a moment, but just even if they were replicating a neighboring home but using a prefab methodology, the amount of waste involved is much, much lower. I think we've all seen construction sites for homes where there are these big dumpster bins full of what looks like a house worth of materials, all of these offcuts and spare pieces. And you don't get that with prefab. When people are building in a factory, every spare piece of material goes back into being reused. So there's a lot less waste, which in itself is very green. The other issue is you get less site noise and runoff and mess which I think is good for the environment as well, because you have these reduced project timelines. But what you also find, the kind of homes we're looking at, this modern architect design prefab, is the architects are building green features into the homes by design. So a lot of these architects that are interested in prefab also have a very strong interest in green design, and so do their clientele. So I think any of these architects doing this work would tell you that they find a high correlation between the kind of customers they have that are interested in progressive design and those that care about the green values of the building. And so these architects are building in photovoltaic cell solutions for providing power, grey water treatment systems, and so forth. So green is definitely linked to prefab, but even if it's not actively designed into it, prefab is in itself much more ecologically responsible than standard building.
Is prefab necessarily modernist, or can prefab housing be any style?
Prefab housing can be any style, and for decades there have been modular prefab builders, generally concentrated in the northeast of the USA, who've built traditional styles, all kinds of styles. But to the extent that architects investigate different modes of modernism, this architect design prefab has tended to have a modernist flavor. And particularly from Dwell's point of view, modernism is a language that we all aspire to.
Michael, tell me about the role of shipping containers in prefab.
Well, shipping containers are being used in prefab by, a certain corner of prefab practitioners. Shipping containers are a building material that some architects are investigating using. They're kind of unusual, and they're very unique in the building world. These are mass-produced. They're kind of ubiquitous globally. These are the icons of globalization. They're at every major port. And in fact, our transportation infrastructure, pretty much everywhere in the world, is optimized for moving containers around. And of course, these containers are usually full of products that are on their way to sit on the supermarket shelves or stores that we go to. But what we find is that these big steel boxes that have been used on ships and on trains and so forth to move products around, they're inherently very strong, and because they're mass-produced, they're actually quite a good cost-benefit ratio there in terms of the amount of structure and strength they provide and their price. So some architects have said, why don't we experiment with designing with these shipping containers? Now, this doesn't mean what they're doing is just taking a container and punching some holes in it for windows and calling it a house. They're using the container as an element in the design in conjunction with other traditional building materials. So the question becomes, what role can these play in a home when combined with other materials? And there's some very interesting design solutions can come from that.
Have you experienced any of these shipping container expressions?
I have. I have visited a shipping container-based home that's in Redondo Beach, a suburb of Los Angeles. There are a range of architects that are working with these. I've been inside that home and had a look. It's a very bold, very interesting space. That particular client in that case wanted the ribbed steel exterior of the containers to be expressed on the exterior of the home. The home is all white. It's been painted all white. But again, it combines a range of other materials. It's not just stacked shipping containers. There are plenty of spaces in the home that are larger than a container because the containers create space that is spanned. You're not constrained just to the space within the container. You can also span and cover spaces between containers. So there are some beautiful designs that, in the hands of the right architect, can result from the use of containers.
Is prefab finally beginning to take off in the U.S.?
Well, if you look at the statistics in terms of the number of homes built with prefab, it's not starting to take off. The construction industry generally is very conservative. It's very slow to adapt. If you look at the changes in building automobiles and ships and aircraft in the past, say, 100 years, there have been massive transformations, not just in the processes, but in the materials. And yet we still largely make homes like we made them 100 years ago by hammering pieces of wood together. And so the construction industry generally is highly resistant to big change. However, the kinds of architects that are working with prefab today, I think are being very influential in the impact they're having on the architecture profession and also the progressive home buyers in terms of choice. And this is what it comes down to, is diversity in choice and design that previously was not available. We don't necessarily all want to live in mass-produced housing that comes from big corporate home builders. And so prefab allows an architect to deliver choice to the marketplace, and that is very influential.
Michael, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, thank you, Carol.
Michael Sylvester is publisher of fabprefab.com. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. CityViews commentator Walker Smith says another word for good communication is trust. And lately, he says businesses have not been communicating well with their customers.
The trust people have in the marketplace is something that business people have always been able to take for granted. Trust is essential to commerce. And until recently, business leaders have never had to worry about it. A few companies have had isolated struggles with trust, but people never lost faith in the marketplace as a whole. Nowadays, though, business leaders take trust for granted at their peril. Absent trust, business just doesn't work. Buyers must have some basis for believing in the representations of sellers, and sellers must feel that they can make plans and investments safely. Trust is the necessary condition for everything else that goes on in the marketplace. Without trust, threats and thuggery are the only ways left to guarantee satisfaction and reward. Unfortunately, trust is now at risk. Businesses are discovering the high cost of buying back the trust that has been squandered by the rash of accounting irregularities and corporate abuses. The uncertainty and worry bred by distrust has shaved billions in value from the public markets and has exacerbated consumer risk aversion and skepticism. Research at my firm, Yankelovich Partners, shows no change in recent years in the percentage of people citing reasonable prices and lots of sales as characteristics important in deciding where to shop. Instead, it's the characteristic of trustworthy prices that is being mentioned by more and more people. Which is to say that what matters is not the price per se, as much as the confidence with which people can take that price at face value. What imperils trust in the marketplace, though, is more than just these corporate scandals. Indeed, if the threat to trust was limited to these frauds, the overall impact would be manageable. After all, these scandals, as bad as they aren't too different from what most people have seen before. The bigger threat to trust comes from something more fundamental. Trust is strongest when a sense of community is part and parcel of commerce, when people believe that everyone has a stake in the success of everyone else, and that no one is using the cover of cooperation to seize unfair advantage. People trust the marketplace when commercial exchanges benefit all parties, buyers as much as sellers, communities as much as corporations. Commerce that works to undermine our communities is not the sort of business you can trust. Mounting disparities are eroding this sense of connectedness and reciprocity, particularly the so-called hourglass economy, in which the middle class has been pushed to the bottom by the growing concentration of wealth at the top. While the boom of the 80s and 90s raised the standard of living for everyone, the growing gap between top and bottom has undermined any sense of common cause. The gnawing disquiet about the lack of shared interests that was lurking beneath the surface has now erupted into public outrage. Of course, it's not as if anybody opposes bigger rewards for the highest achievers, as long as that success is earned, not stolen. Recent disclosures about the late 90s, though, seem to suggest the latter. People feel robbed and betrayed when they learn that some Wall Street analysts were pushing stocks they knew to be bad investments, or that some of the reported earnings growth came from accounting manipulations, not real improvements. Such revelations weaken the sense of a common bond and exacerbate concerns about disparities. Indeed, in the starkest of contrast, people see that the same bankrupt companies that left thousands of individuals bereft of jobs, pensions, and health care also generated exorbitant windfalls for a few CEOs. Communities have gotten stuck with the mess left by these avaricious corporate leaders. There is no magic bullet for this crisis of trust. The challenge it poses requires a solution that goes well beyond just putting a good face on a bad situation. There can be no trust when business leaders demonstrate no interest in the welfare of those who invest in their stocks or who work at their companies. What's required now is a forceful reaffirmation from business leaders of their commitment to the common interest of running honest businesses that build higher value, equitable rewards, more jobs, and stronger communities. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose next national meeting is May 1st and 2nd in San Jose to discuss turning urban amenities into urban assets. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rutt is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.